To be honest, I have desperately tried to avoid doing a sermon on Ferguson, Staten Island, and the latest convulsion of race and racism in our country. I have been quite content to let my colleague Leah do a sermon last fall and throw in a few sentences here and there in an occasional sermon. Personally, I've been thinking, I'll deal with Ferguson when I move to St. Louis. And with everything going on in my personal transition and the beginning of the leadership transition here at the fellowship, I just haven't felt like I've had the emotional or the intellectual bandwidth to do a sermon about race. And if I'm honest with myself, some words come to mind to describe this avoidance. Cop out, denial, dereliction of duty. I make sense of things for myself and hopefully help you make sense of things for yourselves through these sermons. You pay me to think about, to explore, to talk about, to act on the important issues of the day. So not addressing this incredibly important and timely topic finally just felt untenable. So metaphorically kicking and screaming a few weeks ago, I changed the topic this weekend to this topic, and I did so with a deep sense of dread. And there's one other fact about my avoidance of race and racism this fall, this winter, that I must acknowledge out of the gate today. As a white person, I have the privilege of deciding not to address race. If I'm a black living pretty much anywhere in this country, certainly in the Fox Valley, I don't have the luxury of ignoring this issue. Per capita, for example, we heard lately that the arrest rates of blacks in Appleton is higher than that in Ferguson. This is not about somewhere else. It's an issue about here, it's an issue about now, but as a white person, I have the privilege of choosing to ignore this issue even though it's here. It's not staring me in the face on a daily basis. Well, I've tipped my hand about the first premise of my sermon today, and really the title says the same thing. I'm not really talking about somewhere else today. Yeah, I'm going to talk actually very little about Ferguson, Staten Island, Cleveland, and you know so many other places that we haven't heard of but should be burned into our consciousness. But more than anything, today I'm talking about the Fox Valley. When I moved to the Fox Valley from Chicago in 1990, I noticed right away that whenever the topic of race and racism came up, folks here turned their gaze to Milwaukee and to Chicago. There was a sense that, yeah, race is an issue in those places, but not here. There's a word for this sense, fiction. Not true. Race and racism have been huge issues here. Turning our gaze to Milwaukee, to Chicago, to Ferguson, whenever the topic of race comes up, is simply an evasion. And it's an evasion that has very significant consequences. This is why the History Museum at the Castle's traveling exhibit, A Stone of Hope, Black Experiences in the Fox Cities, to me is such a momentous event for this community. And I want to note that if you have not seen the exhibit or want to see it again, you can at the reception after the Martin Luther King celebration on Monday night, and then during the month of April, we'll have the exhibit here at the Fellowship. With historical facts that have long been suppressed and or ignored, Stone of Hope blows the fiction that race is not an issue here right out of the water. And I have to tell you that I found the exhibit to be shocking. Like so many whites here, I bought into this fiction that racism wasn't such a big deal here because, well, we've never had a significant black population. The exhibit reveals that both parts of what I just said are lies. The Fox Cities actually had a thriving black population in the decades following the Civil War. And among that population were veterans of the war. The South had lost the war, but won the peace, and in doing so, the hundreds of thousands of blacks who served in the Union Army were carefully excised from history. At the 50th anniversary at Gettysburg in 1923, as the Confederate and the Union soldiers came together, the veterans, at the culmination of Pickett's charge, they were all white, and they were all pretending that there had been no black soldiers there. And it was in that exact same period of time in the early 20th century that this significant, thriving black population in Appleton disappeared. As the exhibit documents, Klan activity, police harassment, and segregation likely caused the black population to plummet. By 1920, not a single black person lived in Appleton. This is an astonishing transformation. You don't lose a whole thriving minority population in a few decades without vicious racism being at the center of the story, right here in Happy Valley. And then the memory of this thriving black population that once lived here disappeared from white consciousness. And this might be the more amazing thing. The erasure was so complete that a well-meaning white like me, a person who has tried to work on race for 25 years here, was completely unaware of this history. Our worship leader, Connie Roop, and her husband, Peter, both progressive people who have long been involved, as we've heard, in the civil rights movement. They wrote a children's story about the history of Appleton and did not include anything about a thriving black community once existing here. So thorough was the rewrite of history that they did not run across a shred of evidence that that history existed. But many blacks here and well beyond here know and have always known this truth about the Fox Cities. This place and its history is thick with the stench of racism and segregation and hate. Our area continues to struggle with a bad reputation among blacks because of this history. And as activist whites like me, many of us were completely oblivious to this reality. So I would say, in its own way, this area is as steeped in racism and racial strife as Ferguson. If anything, racism has been more thorough here because blacks were completely evicted for decades and the memory of this thriving community was erased from history. This is a powerful racist legacy, and every one of us is part of it. This came home to me when Nick Hoffman, the chief curator of Stone of Hope, did a service in this space last spring. He showed a slide of a post-Crescent newspaper advertisement for a KKK rally in the early 1900s. And I noticed the address of the rally. It took place at the Methodist Church at 800 North Superior Street, our old building. My gosh. For 17 years, this fellowship occupied a building where KKK rallies took place, and none of us knew it. In a TED Talk, Dan Pallotta said, "Injustice isn't coming soon to a town near you. It's already struck your town, and the question simply is, how are you going to show up?" Our white, rewritten history and ignorance has prevented too many of us, me included, from showing up. We'd rather talk about Milwaukee or Chicago or Ferguson, and that keeps us from showing up here. So with the premise that today we're not talking about somewhere else, but about here, this is how I make sense of this latest convulsion of racism in our country. First of all, I think that we whites need to understand that there is ample reason for blacks to mistrust and feel angry toward law enforcement and the criminal justice system. There is a centuries-long history of racial disparity and bias in our criminal justice system. It goes back as long as this country's been around. In her Wellspring Wednesday talk this past Wednesday, Michelle Kuhl made this point in a really compelling way. In the 100 years following the Civil War, thousands of blacks were lynched while law enforcement looked on. In 1921, which was right around the disappearance of the black population here, scores and possibly hundreds of blacks were murdered in Tulsa by whites while law enforcement looked on. And as Unitarian Universalists, it's important to note that a newspaper owner whose paper encouraged the violence was a distinguished Unitarian. In more places than we can catalog, Selma comes to mind, especially with the movie just out. It was actually law enforcement officers themselves who did the assaulting. And while it does not always look the same today, the disparity in our criminal justice system keeps humming along. We can see this in the astronomically higher black incarceration rates and in blacks getting killed in disproportionate numbers by police. So this is why there is such a disparity between white and black views of the police. I shared at Wellspring Wednesday that my experience with law enforcement has been positive, like most white people. For me, there's one exception, and the one exception was when I tried to travel into Canada with another white guy and a black woman while I was in college. We were hassled in a way I've never been hassled before by law enforcement, and haven't been hassled that way since. Ultimately, we were refused admittance to Canada for the flimsiest of reasons. And for me, this was just an eye-opening exception to my positive experiences of law enforcement. It exposed me to the privilege that I have obliviously enjoyed and gave me a slight peek, at just how different the black experience of law enforcement can be. To me, this disparity of experience calls all of us who are white to empathy. We need to understand that our white experiences of law enforcement and the criminal justice system are likely very different from black experiences. And rather than ignore those black experiences because we cannot imagine how that could be true, we need to listen with open hearts and open minds to our black sisters and our black brothers. Second, I unapologetically support robust accountability for law enforcement. Police have a sacred charge from the community, and they are given lethal weapons in fulfilling this charge. Our justice system needs to hold them accountable for fulfilling this charge in even-handed legal ways. Police who use excessive force recklessly or brutally should be held accountable for their actions. And at the same time, I understand that most police are conscientious and law-abiding. I don't want to demonize all police. I deeply appreciate the work they do, and I also try to cultivate a sense of empathy for them. Their job is tough. They put themselves in harm's way to an extent I can't even fathom. They have to make split-second, life-and-death judgments with incomplete information. I get all this, I honor all this, but this does not mean that I'm willing to give them a free pass when they violate the law. It is not anti-police to say that police brutality is wrong. It's not anti-police to say that perpetrators of police brutality should be held accountable to the full extent of the law. Here's an analogy that I find helpful from my own world. Most clergy don't sexually abuse children and or adults in their congregations, but a few do, and I think there needs to be a high degree of accountability for clergy who perpetrate abuse, and I don't feel like I'm being anti-clergy in saying that. Third, until we rid our land and our souls of the scourge of racism, and clearly we have a long ways to go, we whites need to say loudly, clearly, and often that Black Lives Matter. We need to say this with our voices and, more importantly, with our actions. Slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, medical experiments like that at Tuskegee, keeping a chokehold on an unarmed black man to the point he dies, shooting a 12-year-old black kid who has a pellet gun and then letting him bleed out while you stand by, massively incarcerating blacks, these things all send a relentless message that black lives do not matter. For centuries, black lives in our country have mattered a whole lot less than white lives. Tragically, this is, I think, historical and contemporary truth. And there is only one antidote to this, and it is saying with our words and our deeds that black lives matter. I can share that there's been a lot of backlash against the Black Lives Matter movement in our overwhelmingly white Unitarian Universalist faith. Often this backlash is manifested by insisting we need to be saying all lives matter, not Black Lives Matter. Okay, yes, all lives do matter. I believe this deeply. Our UU belief in the inherent dignity and worth of all people, I think, requires that we believe this. But right now, and for too many centuries in our country and our community, Black lives simply have not mattered as much as white lives. For this reason, we need to say and we need to act on this more specific maxim that Black lives matter. Watering this down to all lives matter, to me, aids and abets the perpetuation of racism. So here's another analogy. When our fellowship decided to become intentionally welcoming of gays, lesbians, bisexuals, transgender, and queer people, we figured out that we needed to say this specifically. Many straight people in Unitarian Universalist congregations in the 70s, 80s, 90s resisted saying this. No, they said, we need to say that we welcome everyone. Sexual orientation doesn't matter. The truth is that sexual orientation and gender identity do matter. They matter a lot. Sometimes they matter to the point of being an issue of life or death. Do you think being gay didn't matter to Matthew Shepard? In the face of homophobia and heterosexism and centuries of exclusion within Unitarian Universalists and other faith communities, we need to say specifically and loudly that we welcome LGBTQ people. Too often saying everyone is welcome means a continuation of the old subtle exclusion. So what do we do in the face of continued struggle with racism here and elsewhere in our country? Where do we go from here? If we don't do something, this is all a bunch of hot air. So here's what I think we should do. And I want to be actually really clear here. By we, I mean those of us who are white. I'm not going to presume to tell Black people or other people of color what they should do about racism. I think that each one of us who is white should first of all look within ourselves and honestly explore our own racism and our own privilege. Doing the work of justice cannot happen if we don't individually do this work. And in a spiritual community like this, we have an opportunity to do this work together as well. And I hope that this fellowship will seriously engage in this work in the next couple years. It is essential if we want to really become a leader of racial justice in this community. We need to cultivate our empathy and our understanding of people different from us. Instead of responding to Black stories of abuse and harassment by law enforcement with disbelief and reference to our own positive experiences, we need to try to walk a mile in a Black person's shoes. For me, cultivating a sense of humility is a great strategy for this work. We need to say in our words and our deeds that Black lives matter. I think we need to get involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. In that quotation from Dan Pallotta I used earlier, he says quite simply, you know, how are you showing up? We need to show up. And in showing up, we need also to be sensitive to not taking over the movement, which is something white people have a tendency to do. We also need to work on how our fellowship can say Black Lives Matter in the same way that we've said we welcome GLBTQ people. I believe we need to be nonviolent in this work of racial justice. And I have to acknowledge that I say this with profound uncertainty. To me, it's plainly evident that legal slavery in this country would have continued without the horrific violence of the Civil War. It's plainly evident that the Holocaust and its breathtakingly systematized racism would have continued without the violence of World War II. And yet, like Gandhi, like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I remain committed to nonviolence. It is a faith stand for me, even as I acknowledge this ambiguity. And finally, we must remain engaged in this hard-wrenching work of racial justice, even though those of us who are white have the privilege of standing by and ignoring this. And I think we also must remain hopeful. Lawrence University President Mark Burstein sent out a really beautiful message after that grand jury decision in Ferguson not to indict Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown. Burstein quoted the veteran civil rights leader John Lewis from his 2005 convocation at Lawrence. "America," John Lewis said, "is a better place. We are better people because we are in the process of laying down the burden of race and creating the beloved community, a community at peace with itself. None of us, no one, should give up. Not one of us should throw in the towel. It is in keeping with the movement, in keeping with the philosophy and discipline of nonviolence, to be hopeful." So, friends, we need to listen to our black sisters and our black brothers and understand that we do have a long ways to go to get to the beloved community. And we, each one of us, regardless of our race or ethnicity, need to keep working on fulfilling this beautiful dream here, now.